the fungus was introduced probably fairly recently from Europe. We know that now because we have the total genome of the fungus and the genome of the fungus in Europe that was its source. The fungus was introduced, discovered in 2006 in a commercial cave in New York State that is visited annually by 100,000 people. And probably, though we'll never really know the exact source, the fungus probably came in on the shoes or backpack of a tourist.
When you say commercial cave, you mean people pay money, they come in, they look at the bats, they look at the cave, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
In North America, the syndrome has killed, what, almost 7 million bats, something like that?
Fish and Wildlife Service is estimating between 5 and 6 million bats at this stage.
Does Europe have the same problem?
No. We now know that the fungus does live on bats in Europe, but it doesn't kill the bats. It's not at all atypical of other invasive species where in their native range they have predators, parasites, whatever that controls them, or they are co-evolved with the hosts. We can think of many, many examples.
Now, you're part of a group that is actually studying this fungus, right?
Correct.
What have you figured out so far?
So what we have is a disease that started at a point source, like I just said, an introduction almost certainly, that is rapidly spread across at least the eastern half of North America. And our project is basically to look at the epidemiology of this disease, to plot its spread across the continent, and hopefully to discover solutions to quell the spread of the fungus. A major tool that we have is a genetic marker. We can go in and we can swab the bats with cotton swabs, swab the bats, and then from that swab, isolate the DNA of the fungus. So we can actually identify the presence of the fungus on the bats without having to visually see the white nose, so to speak. It's called white nose because the first reports of people seeing the fungus was that they saw fluffy white fungal growth on the nose of the bats. The real damage is actually caused by the growth of the fungus into the tissue of the bats, particularly the wing tissue.
Well, obviously, humans can carry this fungus. It can be carried everywhere.
Humans transmit the fungus, and that's one of the real concerns we have. One of the most controversial aspects of the disease since it's come here is that there have been, on state and federal lands, mandatory closure of caves to keep people out. Private land, it's voluntary but recommended. There's no question that people can carry this fungus, though it doesn't infect people. The fungus grows at cold temperatures. And this is the really insidious thing about this fungus. Optimal growth is at the same temperatures as the bats when they hibernate. So when bats go into caves to hibernate for the winter, they drop their body temperatures typically down to the ambient temperature or close to the ambient temperature in the cave. Well, this is the optimal growth temperature for this fungus. The other sort of insidious thing about this disease is that when the bats drop their body temperatures down and go into torpor, they shut down all their physiological processes, or they slow them way down. And one of the things that they shut down is their immune system. So while the bat is torpid for the winter, the fungus infects the bat, invades the tissue of the bats. Then when spring comes, the bat wakes up and it's got all this fungal intrusions in its wing membranes and stuff, and the immune system turns on, the bat's immune system turns on, and wham, the neutrophils all invade the tissue to combat this foreign substance, and the wings get all macerated by the attacking immune system, and they get huge lesions. And if the bats don't survive probably the first week or so after they come out of hibernation, they're going to die. When they come back to their normal temperature, and the bat's body temperature is a little bit warmer than ours, typically, the fungus won't grow.
Does it affect any other animals like this?
Not that we've been able to document. There are concerns for other hibernating animals, but there's no evidence that they're infecting any other animal. Again, the really interesting thing is that while this fungus grows on bats in Europe, it's not killing them. It's also interesting, in the U.S. and Canada, we have 47 species of bats. Okay, Tennessee, we have 15 different species of bats. Not all bats are affected. There are a number of the bats that live in this area that have never been documented with the disease.
But the fungus is still present.
Right now, we only have one really good candidate species that actually may have some sort of immunity to this fungus. And this is the big-eared bat, which is right in the middle of the infected zone, what is now the infected zone. And the fungus has been reported on big-eared bats, but there's been no documentation of the disease. So far, we've got seven species of bat that have been documented having the disease, that is having this tissue erosion that is typical of the disease. We have three other species on which we have found the fungus, but no evidence of disease. It just may be that it's early in the stages for these species. Of course, what we have is a pathogen that's moving across the continent. It's spreading south, it's spreading north, and it's spreading west. One of the kind of exciting things about being in Tennessee is that given that this is a cold-growing fungus, and as you move farther south, you get into warmer and warmer climates, we're kind of hoping that we would be at the zone where the fungus might start burning itself out. It is progressing more slowly down here.
How far west has it been found?
Well, it's across the Mississippi now. The fungus has been found in Iowa and in Oklahoma, but there is no documentation to date of the disease yet in Iowa or Oklahoma, but there's no reason to expect that we won't have disease there.
Are you determining commonalities among the bats that seem particularly susceptible to it and those that are immune, like the big-eared bat?
Yes, we certainly are. What are the social factors? What are the possible physiological factors? So the big-eared bat that has not yet shown the disease, it has big ears for a reason, and that is that it's a gleaning bat. It flies low over vegetation, uses its big ears to detect insects, and it is particularly well known to be active throughout the winter. So we think that may be really a life-saving and it's something that we're optimistically clinging to. When white nose first came into Tennessee, it was 2010, so it's been here for 3 years now. 3 years after it was first noted, when it first moved into Pennsylvania, 80% of the bats were dead. We don't have anything like 80% of our bats dead here yet, but the disease is killing bats here. We have some of the very same species of bats here that occur in Pennsylvania and New York, and we have some other species. So there are commonalities. We can look and say, well, Indiana bats, which is a federally listed endangered species that is being hit particularly hard, it occurs here as well as up in New York. Gray bats are also a federally listed endangered species that do not occur in New York, but are here. Gray bats have a unique life history in that they spend both their winters and the summers in caves. Is this going to make them particularly vulnerable? One thing we have learned is that the fungus does persist in the caves. So the fungus, there is a reservoir for this disease in the sediments of the caves. So it's particularly difficult to think of how you're going to decontaminate an area. You can't go in and spray Lysol in a cave because you'll kill everything else, too.
On that subject.
Yes.
Earlier this month, I was reading in the BBC that the Aroostook National Wildlife Refuge in Maine, they've started the Bats in Bunkers program, where they're using old Cold War bunkers, moving bats into these bunkers so that it's a man-made area that they can go in and scrub in the times that these bats are not present. What do you think of that?
I think it's a cool idea. And we got to do whatever we can. You may not know, but there's an artificial cave that was built in Tennessee, up near Clarksville. There's a very large gray bat colony, and I said gray bats are federally listed endangered species. The Nature Conservancy has control of one of these very large hibernacula for gray bats, and on adjacent property, they built an artificial cave. And it's exactly the same idea, that this could provide a refuge that could be cleaned out and where the reservoir fungus could be and the bats would have a place to go, a safe haven. I mean, part of our problem is we don't know what we can do, really. And that's the case with a lot of these sorts of introductions. I mean, that this thing is in, it's ravaging through the fauna, and we're watching it. We're trying to learn what factors make some animals more vulnerable than others, which is interesting. And from the point of view of an ecologist, an evolutionary biologist, and a disease ecologist, it's fascinating. From the point of view of a bat biologist, it's really tragic.